I'm going to start with the basics. I don't know how much people do or don't know, so I've always found it's better to assume that it's to start with the basics and work your way forward. So this is, as you can see, a map of Brazil. Brazil is the sixth largest country in the world. It's slightly smaller than the continental United States. It has a population of about 208 million, which is the fifth largest in the world. And it consists of about 53% mixed race, which are black, native, Asian, and about 47% white, which would be identified for us as more as European. It has the eighth largest economy in the world with a GDP of about $3.24 trillion U.S. dollars. So I'm going to give you a little bit of history going back to the military dictatorship, which began in 1964, because I don't think you can understand what's going on in Brazil today unless you have some of this history. So this gentleman here, his name is João Goulart, who's known as Django. He was elected as the vice president of Brazil in 1960. Actually, he served a term in 56 as vice president also. And he assumed the presidency in 1961 when the elected president resigned. There's a lot of intrigue about that resignation. People thought Django was in Africa on a diplomatic tour, and they thought that the resignation was a prelude to a coup. That's why the president resigned. But Django took over after certain battles that would be reminiscent of Chicago City Council wars. He was finally established as the president by 1962. He initiated a lot of progressive projects to combat adult illiteracy, widespread use of the teachings of Paulo Freire, for those who know who he is. They had a universal university reform and prohibited the operation of private schools. It was imposed that 15% of income produced in Brazil would be directed to education. He did tax reform, control of any transfer of profits by multinational companies with headquarters abroad was to be prohibited. It had to be reinvested in Brazil. An income tax proportional to profit, to income. Electoral reform, extension of voting rights to illiterate people and low-ranking military officers who weren't allowed to vote before that. And most importantly, at least for the work I do, land reform, that non-productive properties larger than 6 hectares would be expropriated and redistributed to the population by the government. At that time, the agricultural population was much larger. So, of course, this initiated a coup. The most powerful forces in Brazil are the landowning forces, the large landowners that descend back to the Portuguese. So, as the slide shows, that rural-urban migration in the early 60s helped to fuel a land reform movement. The Ligas Camponesas, which are the peasant leagues, led by Francisco Julião, President João Goulart sided with the Ligas and was deposed by a military coup on March 31, 1964. For 24 years, the military government largely pushed industrialization. So here's just some scenes of the military coup. Tanks, that's the capital, the iconic capital of Brazil, with the Senate and the House domes and the administrative buildings in the middle, military buildings in the middle. This is then just more pictures of the tanks rolling down in Brasilia. This is at the palace, what was the palace in Rio de Janeiro, and this was the legislature essentially endorsing the coup at one point. All during the 24 years of the coup, they had elections. The elections weren't prohibited. They continued to have elections. They just limited who could run. So every year, and the Constitution prohibited an active military officer from being president of the country. So a general would resign, run for the presidency, and then become president, and they kept a succession of military officers in the presidency. There was only two parties permitted, jokingly referred to by those as the Yes Party and the Yes Sir Party. As I said, the Brazilians will tell you that their definition of a dictatorship is a system where there's only two political parties, and they're both support capitalism. So think about that for us. So this is Luis Ignacio da Silva, known as Lula. Lula was born into poverty in the Northeast. Oops, I didn't get the map up. The Northeast is the corner where, right around where the Atlantic, where the country is surrounded, of course, by the Atlantic, up in that corner, if you remember from the map. At age 9, with his mother and 7 brothers and sisters, they migrated to Sao Paulo in the back of a flatbed truck. Lula has little formal education and began working in the automobile factories at an early age. Brazil has an extensive automobile industry. It's not domestic in the sense of it's all foreign companies, Ford, Chevy, Renault, Fiat, and became a leader in the union movement. So during the military dictatorship, and by the late 70s, he led several large strikes that were ruled illegal and thus ended up in prison. And that's his prison photo. So the movement against the military dictatorship picked up steam. And the slogan was direct elections now, as you can see from this. In the poster, it says, the hour is now. Massive demonstrations. There's the one on the lower left, I guess, as you're looking at it, is Lula addressing a crowd. That's a picture of an anti-coup or anti-military dictatorship rally in I think that was in Rio de Janeiro. So in 1979, Lula and helped found the Workers' Party. PT stands for Partido de Trabalhadores, so but we'll just call it the Workers' Party or the PT. And it was founded under the leadership of the union leaders, including Lula and other intellectuals. So this is the discussions. These are the meetings in which the party was founded. They worked with all the other parties to try to get a coalition that could support it. And they were able to get some unity in order to oppose the dictatorship. Dilma Rousseff, we'll talk about more, took a different route in opposing the military dictatorship. She's the daughter of Bulgarian immigrants and was raised in an upper middle class household in Belo Horizonte, which is in the state called Minas Gerais, which is General Mines. She became a socialist in her youth, and after the 64 coup d'etat, joined the left-wing and Marxist urban guerrilla force that fought against the military dictatorship. She was captured, tortured, and jailed from 1970 to 1972. In 2002, Lula was elected president, took office in 2003. He formed a coalition, both for the electoral purposes and also for to get a majority in Congress so they could continue to their programs. And that's just parties in Lula's electoral coalition. Yeah, one's the Communist Party of Brazil, and the other one's the Brazilian Communist Party. And I can't tell you what the different tendencies are. I really don't know. I mean, as well, we saw later, the candidate for the Workers' Party now, his vice presidential candidate is from the Communist Party of Brazil, a woman. So Lula and the Workers' Party initiated a number of programs. So one of them is Fome Zero, which means zero or no hunger. They launched it. It takes a number of forms, ranging from direct financial aid to the poorest families and to diverse strategies such as creating cisterns in Brazil's semi-arid areas, which is in the Northeast, creating low-cost restaurants, educating people about healthy eating habits, distributing vitamins and iron supplements, and supporting subsistence family farming. They also initiated what's known, Bolsa Família, which means family purse or pocketbook, is a cash transfer program which currently gives families with per capita income below 140 Brazilian reais, which is about $56 U.S., a monthly stipend of 32 reais per vaccinated child under 16 years old who is attending school. So they made two requirements, that the children get vaccinated. Secondly, that they attend school. So there's also additional subsidies, but these are cash transfer programs. There's no judgment on how the money is used. The money is transferred, and of course they found over time that families are going to spend the money to feed their children and clothe their children and house themselves. In office 2003, they started these programs immediately, but they didn't get up and running for a year or so. So they give you essentially debit cards. They call citizen cards, which is how they had the money transfers and money is just put into your account. So he also initiated a lot of large infrascale projects like this dam. He was elected to a second term in 2006, and when he left the presidency in 2011, he was arguably the most popular politician in Brazilian history with an approval rating of 87%. On June 13th, 2010, after more than 2 years of widespread speculation, Dilma Rousseff launched her campaign as official president candidate of the Workers' Party. With the promise of maintaining Lula's popular policies, Rousseff was able to surpass José Serra, the conservative candidate, in the polls by late July. In spite of maintaining a wide margin over him, she did not receive the 50% necessary to avoid a runoff election. In the runoff, she received 56% of the votes and became, on January 1st, 2011, became the first woman president in Brazilian history. On October 26, 2014, she was reelected president for a second term, securing more than 51% of the votes in the closest election since 1989. Despite Dilma's reelection, there were two troubling trends going on in Brazilian society: ongoing corruption scandals and an economy which ended a recession. The largest of these scandals is called Lava Jato, which translates as to Operation Car Wash. It's called that because the money transfers were done at a currency exchange located inside a filling station in Brasilia. So they called that Operation Car Wash. Now, Brazil has endured corruption throughout its entire history. Brazil, unlike the United States, prohibits direct corporate contributions to candidates. So, you know, in order to get that corporate money, there's a lot of subterfuge going on. So, but it's illegal when you get caught, unlike our system where it's perfectly legal. There was also, during Lula's presidency, a scandal where monthly payments were made to from the Workers' Party to other parties in order to secure their votes on some of these programs. So with the discovery of a massive offshore oil deposit in 2007, Petrobras, Brazil's state oil company, was in a position to sign contracts worth billions of dollars for construction of drilling platforms, pipeline, refining infrastructure. Odebrecht, Latin America's largest construction company, Brazilian-based, has admitted paying bribes in the millions of dollars to politicians in order to get contracts. It is estimated that the total amount of bribes paid during Operation Car Wash exceeds $1 billion. Of course, the scandal had little impact on Lula, but the Attorney General has charged the current president, Michel Temer, who was a former vice president who took office in August of 2016, with receiving money from a giant meatpacking plant, and it was the transfers or the discussions were recorded on tape. The second major issue was Brazil had started sliding into a recession. So in about 2014, the economy took a downturn. It contracted by 3.6% in 2016, and it's now about 8% smaller than it was in 2014. The country has been hard hit by falling commodity prices and an internal political crisis, of course, that undermined investor confidence. Unemployment rate, the number of unemployed rose by 76% to 12.9 million, which is about 12.6% of the working population. Its key exports are soy, oil, now metals, and they make a jet that, like the Gulfstream jet, one of their big industries. So starting in about in 2015, Globo, the giant media corporation, which controls the vast amount of the media in Brazil, started ginning up through its newspapers, radio, TV, anti-Gilma sentiment. And they helped to organize large street protests against corruption and the recession. The media, along with right-wing parties, started calling for Dilma's impeachment, and although she'd never been implicated in any corruption scandal or any other corruption at all, so they had to create a new reason. This is sort of an iconic picture. This is one of the protests of the wealthy against Dilma, and they can't even stroll their own babies. They had to bring their nanny along to the protest. So they started initiating an impeachment process. So let me just give you a quick rundown on how impeachment works in Brazil. It's very similar to ours. Okay, so their government's very structured, very similar to ours. They have an executive branch headed by the president, and then the various ministries of education, defense, etc. They have a judicial branch headed by the Supreme Court, and then lower courts, regional courts. It's pretty much like our circuit courts. And they have a legislative branch with two chambers, a Senate, which has 81 senators, which is three from each of Brazil's 26 states, and three from the federal district, which is like our D.C., where the capital is. And they have a chamber of deputies, which is like our House of Representatives, which has 513 members elected in proportion to the population. So Articles 85 and 86 of the Brazilian Constitution provide for in the impeachment process. And what happens is the Speaker of the House, if somebody submits an impeachment petition to the Speaker of the House, he or she is obligated to proceed with it, and they form a committee to investigate. If the committee votes, it'd be like our judicial committee. If the committee votes yes, then it goes to the full chamber. It takes a two-thirds vote in what would be their House of Representatives to send the impeachment process to the Senate for a trial. Then the Senate, by a majority vote, considers whether the matter should be tried. If that vote passes, then there's a trial in the Senate which requires a two-thirds vote to convict, similar to ours. But once that majority vote occurs, the president is stripped, in this case, of her powers, and it is no longer president, and the vice president steps up, at least till the end of the process. So once they've done that, Dilma, which they did, Dilma, and the law is that they have 180 days to decide whether to convict or not. If they fail to do so in 180 days, she's reinstated for power. So the official reason for her impeachment was that she diverted funds from a federal bank to cover cash flow shortfalls in government programs. All the funds were repaid to the federal bank, a practice that Brazilian presidents have used, well, every Brazilian president's used. Technically, it's not permitted under the Constitution, but it's not really considered a crime either. So they decide, well, we're gonna use this against her. So imagine what it means. It means like essentially you're saying, okay, we're gonna borrow money from a state bank, a bank owned by the federal government. We're gonna pay these, so we continue paying the social programs, which is what it was for, is to be used for these Fome Zero and the Bolsa Família programs. And then when the tax revenue comes in, we repay it. And that's what happened, and it was all repaid. So under the Brazilian Constitution, and I don't want to get too technical here, you need to have evidence of a crime in order to impeach. And this is, the sign says, and the thing says, impeachment without a crime is a coup, which is what that sign says in Portuguese. But, you know, that wasn't, of course, as we get, I'm going to describe in a few minutes, that's not what really, why Dilma was impeached. In fact, during the impeachment vote in the House of Deputies, only about 7% of the deputies voting for impeachment gave as their reason for voting crimes. In other words, you're supposed to say, each person steps up to the podium and says, I vote for impeachment because she committed this crime. No, instead they stepped up there and they said she was being impeached for such things as for the birthday of my granddaughter, for the foundations of Christianity, for rural producers, because if they don't plant, there will be no lunch or dinner, to end the profitability of being unemployed or a layabout, for an end to welfare dependency, and dozens of other equally disgusting comments. And this just shows you the fact that they couldn't handle, first of all, a woman president, and they couldn't handle a progressive president. So what that says is tchau, querida, which translates into like goodbye, dear, or goodbye, sweetie, slightly patronizing, I would say. Just another misogynic insult for the country's first woman president. This fellow, there's the vote of the in the Chamber of Deputies. This fellow, who we're going to talk about more later, his name is Jair Bolsonaro. He gave his reason for casting his vote. He cast his vote in honor of a human rights abusing colonel from Brazil's military dictatorship who was personally responsible for Rousseff's torture. His son, Eduardo, proudly cast his vote in honor of the military men of 64, the ones who led the coup. So, of course, she was impeached for not having a crime, but this fellow, this is Michel Temer, who's now the president, he was accused and under indictment for political corruption, which includes those accused of or under indictment in the Congress are about 60% of the members of Congress. So, you know, part of what's going on here, which I'll talk about in a minute, is they're protecting their own rear ends. So this guy, he's accused of accepting a $1.5 million in bribes from the construction company that Odebrecht I talked about, and he's the one who helped push through the impeachment, even though he was vice president. So up until the early 1960s, before the coup, the president and vice president ran separately. So you could have, you know, they were not as a ticket together. After they were required to be on the same ticket together, so you'd vote for both of them at the same time, they're not required to be of the same party. And so it's not uncommon for the president to get a vice presidential candidate from another party who they help think will shore up their vote, to get their vote, and also to get in Congress. It's like sort of a quasi-parliamentary concept, you know, where you bring coalitions of other parties in order to get elected prime minister. This guy was known as a centrist, but he wasn't known as what he's become to this day, even though, again, he was involved in corruption. This fellow is Eduardo Cunha. He's an evangelical Christian. He was the president of the Chamber of Deputies. In other words, he's the one who initiated the impeachment process. Of course, he's also tainted with scandal. When he was the subsecretary of housing in the state of Rio de Janeiro, he was forced to resign over bidding irregularities in construction contracts. Now he's accused of stashing some $40 million in bribes and kickbacks in Swiss bank accounts. As I mentioned before, 60% of the 594 members of Brazil's Congress, the ones voting to impeach, face serious charges of bribery, electoral fraud, illegal deforestation, kidnapping, and homicide. Yes, homicide. So they voted for impeachment of the Chamber of Deputies in April, and in August, the Senate convicted her. Immediately, I want to comment on one of the reasons why they could carry such a two-thirds vote in both chambers. And part of this, and this is from a rural perspective, so you understand how the political inequality in Brazil. So this goes up through 2005, but Brazil's largest landlords were represented by one federal deputy for every 236 families, while landless peasants had one federal deputy for every 612,000 families. So the political representation of landlords was 2,587 times greater than that of the landless peasants. How do they do that? Money. Money, money, money. You know, they control the votes. They control in the rural areas. Just think about it in here. Think about it, that the fact that South Dakota with 650,000 people has two senators, and California with 40 million has two senators. So there's unequal representation that can, and in this, in the Chamber of Deputies, you know, the areas are dense, can be populated, but the landlord controls. So it's not atypical in Brazilian families that property-owning families, the elite, for the oldest son, always male, to inherit the land, the next son to go into the military and become a colonel, and the next son to go into the judiciary. So the family can control all aspects of anything that threatened them. No, other people, poor people can become priests. Because we can talk about that some other time. Brazil still has a fairly large progressive Catholic community. That's another subject. So as a result of this political inequality, the largest landlords have access to $1,587 from the public for every dollar made available to a landless family. So immediately after this right-wing coup, they started launching a neoliberal program. not surprising. The real question is, and I'm going to quote here from João Pedro Stadile, who is one of the leaders of the landless workers movement. And he says, the true aim of the coup in Brazil was not Dilma, who had a terrible second term where she bowed to business leaders. The problem is in the deep crisis we are experiencing as a horrific economy. We depend on international capitalism and capitalists who have a need to completely control the situation to impose a neoliberal plan. The neoliberal project is the only way they know how to protect their interests and save themselves. The plan foresaw the application of classist capitalist measures in a time of crisis, meaning to raise exploitation of work by raising unemployment, decreasing salary, increasing working hours, eliminating rights, cutting the expenditures on public resources destined to health, education, and agrarian reform, instead putting them all in the service of private accumulation of capital, privatizing natural resources to reap extraordinary benefit that can get them out of the crisis. That's why they're taking the oil in the offshore area, the mines, the water, the biodiversity, and they also want the lands to privatize the last state companies, which is the Petrobras, the oil company. There's a national electric company, and also all power, transportation, ports, airport sector. So the coup was to help to get them out of the economic crisis as much as it was to get rid of Dilma. She was just somebody in the way. So the government announced a plan of privatizations. Additionally, they proposed a constitutional amendment that would freeze increases in public expenditures for 20 years. I would say public expenditures, that's for social programs. So when I say public expenditures, of course, given the inflation rate, essentially it's a decrease. So the inflation has been running about 2.5%. Another projected form was the reform of their social security system to raise the minimum retired age and limit the proportionality between minimum salary and retirement pensions. A change in labor legislation is also in the agenda, and to restrict such rights as vacations, bonuses, and limits on working hours. So the plan in which they're implementing is the neoliberal agenda. The other reason for the coup was to stop the corruption investigations. As you can imagine, with 60% of the members of Congress under investigation, the best way to get control of it is just to stop it, or essentially give themselves some form of amnesty. Otherwise, why would they? I mean, one of the reasons is for this corruption. I'll leave it at that. So these are some of the protests against Social Security. This is João Pedro Stadile, one of the leaders of the MST, who I quoted I just quoted. So this is some of the actions post coup of the people organizing, rising up. So this says Brazil. With democracy, we're not going to have a coup. We're going to have struggle. This says in the streets in defense of democracy. This says people without fear. No, we're not going to sell. Essentially, they're saying we're not going to sell the assets. Here's some of the protests. That's in Brasilia. That's in São Paulo. That's in, I don't know where this is at, but it's another one. These are some of the signs. So golpe. And that the symbol in the O is the symbol for global news. So it says, coup no more. We're going to continue in the streets until we stop the coup. Yeah, these are all in 2015. And it was started in 2014 before the coup, and then after the coup was in 2016. So there's protests there. And then in 2017, a lot of the protests were around Social Security, the elimination of the changing of Social Security. One of the effects of the coup has been, and this may all sound familiar to those of us here in the U.S., a ramp up in violence, against the poor, against urban youth, black youth essentially. So this quote, this is a poster that was out there. It says, 2 years after the coup, violence and precariousness of work in the countryside. This is some more of the protests. Fora Temer means out with Temer. So one of the things that happened was a city councilor in Rio de Janeiro, a woman named Marielle Franco, black woman, openly gay, was shot down, was assassinated. She was driving home from a meeting, and people came up and just shot her in the car and shot her driver. To this date, the case is still open, but this is just one example, there's been lots of, and this is a picture of a memorial service for Marielle. They were held throughout the world, all through Europe, Latin America. She was quite a well-known figure. She'd be like comparable to Ocasio.
Berta
Caceres, I think it's pronounced. So I'm going to show you some other pictures going on of the protests that have been continuing, because the protests have never stopped since the coup. We don't hear about them here, but there's protests. A lot of them are road blockades, you know, where they said burning tires across the roads to stop commerce, to make things done. And there was a general strike as part of the protests against the Social Security reform that pretty much shut down the country. And there was about 2 million people in the streets. There's a lot more young people on the street than probably older people. But I've never seen a demographics of the breakdown. A lot of this is led by the landless workers movement, the MST, because of the fact that they have, you know, thousands and thousands of cadre that can get out and organize people. And so they're not focusing much on land reform now. They're out doing this organizing, which I think is really important. The elites knew that just by getting rid of Dilma and putting Temer in, because his term ends January 1st, 2019, and there's an election going on right now, which we're going to talk about next. Just by doing that alone, it was insufficient to stop, you know, the progressive tide. They had to get rid of Lula. Lula was still the most popular politician. He was eligible to run again, because the Brazilian Constitution says you can only have two consecutive terms. So he had two consecutive terms, and then Dilma had a term and a half before she was impeached, so he was eligible to run again. Polling that took place earlier this year, late in 2017 and early this year, showed that he would probably win in the first round. Brazil has a runoff system where you need to get over 50% in order to get elected. If you don't, the top two vote-getters are in a runoff about three weeks later from the first election. They had to trump up a reason to get Lula out of the picture. I mean, here's your picture of Lula at a rally. And I always like this picture here. This is kind of shows that, you know, the people remember his role in bringing down the dictatorship. So, you know, top is in 1979, leading the strikes in the auto factories, and this was in 2018, as he's already actually been indicted at this point. So, I'm gonna go into a little detail here, so you understand why most of us who have looked at this believe that Lula's a frame-up job, because a lot of people say, "Oh, you know, it's just part of the corruption, just part of this operation car wash corruption." So in order to convict a politician of corruption, you have to, in Brazil, under Brazilian law, you have to prove that the politician favored someone or a private company or interest group in exchange for compensation. So they lacked any material evidence connecting Lula with corruption or money laundering, but they were able to gather evidence. So Sergio Moro, who's a low-level judge who was put in charge of Lula's case, obviously wanted to become a higher-level judge, think Kavanaugh, comes from the testimony of one from a fellow who was a former president of a Brazilian construction company. And some say that, you know, he was already in prison. And reports show that his plea deal was cut off when he refused at first to testify against Lula. So then his sentence was reduced by 2/3 to be served under house arrest when she agreed to testify, which probably tells you something. But his testimony alone was not enough to, you know, because it was somewhat discredited, of course. So they tried to find another legal loophole, and this judge created a new category of official corruption called an undetermined official act, or potential official act. So now we're into potential crimes. As the Brazilian newspaper just Nexo describes it, according to Moro, and the judges of the Federal Regional Court of the Fourth Region, that'd be like the circuit courts, who confirmed the conviction, Lula practiced passive corruption even without an official act in favor of the construction company. In return, the contractor won overpriced contracts with Petrobras, the oil company, the government oil company. There is no direct connection between Lula and these contracts, but according to the magistrates, as president of the republic, he had control over the appointment of directors that closed the contracts. In other words, so they're saying he appoints the directors to the oil company, since it's a state-owned oil company, and because he appointed the directors who accepted the contracts, he's liable if in fact they were under corruption. Clearly, he was jailed for solely for because they wanted. They said he accepted an apartment, a seaside apartment worth like $1.2 million. Although he's never been there, no one in his family's never even set foot in the place, and there's no title. I mean, there's nothing. No title was transferred. Nothing. I mean, there's nothing to show he has any connection to it. But they picked this. They just picked this apartment because this corrupt construction company owner said that was Lula, that was the apartment we gave Lula. So there's a lot of impartiality, which I don't want to go into great detail on because it's probably boring. One of the analysis says that one of the things that discredits was the swiftness of the process. So they talk about one of the most important wave features of the new wave of soft coup d'etats sweeping Latin America in recent years. Honduras is an example, is the necessity to disguise an obvious breach in the constitutional order with a supposedly zealous pursuit of due process where time is of the essence. Rousseff's impeachment is a good example of that, although it was never proved that she committed any impeachable crime, which is by itself enough basis for annulment of the whole process. So it's an affront to the rule of law. But they went ahead and convicted Lula, and then they decided that wasn't enough. They had to put him in jail because just conviction would mean that he could probably, you know, still win the election and continue to fight it. Article 5, a section of the Brazilian Constitution says that no one shall be considered guilty before the issuance of a final and unappealable penal sentence. In other words, if you're convicted and you still have rights of appeal all the way up until it's finally denied, saying, you know, we're not going to take it, you're not considered guilty. So technically, Lula has several levels of appeal left to him that they're being pursued. So technically, he's not guilty. That's why under the Brazilian Constitution, you can't incarcerate somebody until the final appeal is done. Right, they don't have this system where you wait 3 years in jail before you even get a trial, like we do here, the bond system. So there's arguments that you know, so they filed a habeas corpus petition to get Lula out, and they filed what's called direct actions for declaration of constitutionality, or ADCs. And these direct actions were supported by the Brazilian Bar Association. They were supported and they were filed, but the Chief Justice decided to rule on the habeas corpus position before these ADCs had actually been presented to them, which is again a violation. Further, there was an order to release Lula from the district court where he was convicted, the Fourth District Court. And that then was overturned without authority by two other judges. So you can see that they're scrambling. He still was going to run for the presidency from jail. Think of, also I can't remember his name, who ran during World War I. He ran for the socialist candidate. Yes, Eugene Debs ran for the presidency from prison. And so he's still going to run. But the Supreme Electoral Committee barred that, even though the United Nations Human Rights Committee, I think I'm behind on my, so there's in support of Lula, I'm sorry, this a vigil outside of the jail where Lula is being held in Curitiba, which is a state capital of the state of Paraná. These are some of the posters. Obviously, we've translated them into English, so we can use them here. So this court, the court finally ruled that he was ineligible to run. There's a law called the Clean Slate Law, which they passed that said anybody who's been convicted of corruption can't run for public office for 8 years after the conviction, which and theoretically makes sense. I mean, if you think about it, to be barred from, if you've been guilty of public corruption, you shouldn't be able to jump right back into it. But the United Nations Human Rights Committee said that in Lula's case, since the conviction wasn't final and it was questionable in the first place, it should not have barred him from running, but he is barred. So the Workers' Party had to pick a new candidate. The fellow in the middle is his name is Haddad, and he was the Minister of Education under Lula. He's not very well known across the country, and this is after he spoke with Lula in jail, and they're continuing with the program. So the first round was of the elections were October. I'm trying to get the date. 8th. It was Sunday. It was a few Sundays ago. The 8th. And Jair Bolsonaro. I'm going to show you the two candidates. Jair Bolsonaro on the left, on your left, and Fernando Haddad on the right are the two candidates that are running. Because Bolsonaro came close. He got somewhere between 46-47%, but he didn't get enough. So, Bolsonaro is a neo-fascist. There's no other way to describe him. He has a long history of this, so it's not just something he put up. He is definitely in the mold of Trump, except he's sort of taken it to another level. Just some sort of they're typical examples, but you know, there was he got into a conflict with one another when he was a congressman, a deputy. He got into a conflict with a female deputy, and then at one point, because they've been arguing, he went and he turned to her and said, "Don't worry, I'm not going to rape you. You're not worth it." And she said, "Well, if you did, I would strike you if you tried." And he said, "I'd strike you back." And then he went and shoved her. You know, I mean, just didn't push her down, but shoved her. He's incredibly homophobic. He says that that if your child shows any signs of homosexuality, the thing you got to do is whip them until they stop. And he means with a whip. I mean, I'm talking about flailing your own children. He's fascistic. He supported the 64 coup, still does. He was in the military. He said the problem with the 64 coup is it didn't go far enough. And that they gave up too soon. He said if they would have killed about another 30,000 people, they would have been able to cement the dictatorship on a more permanent basis. And he's racist, which shouldn't surprise you. Probably, he says the problem in Brazil is there are too many single black mothers. His running mate is also a military guy. Their program is to allow anybody to carry a gun who wants to carry a gun. Sound familiar? Because they, you know, and Brazil does have a severe crime problem. Let's be clear about that. I mean, there were 66,000 murders in Brazil last year. So I mean, that's a lot. So for a country of 200 million. I mean, even the United States, which is a high murder rate, I don't know how many murders there were across the U.S. last year, but it was
10.
5,000 or so, I think. Yes, okay. So maybe half or a little less, more than half of Brazil, which has two-thirds the U.S. population. But they really have no program other than these sensational things they talk about, you know, arming people, you know, sending the military into the favelas, which are the ghettos, you know, to essentially occupy them, which actually they've been doing already. So what you really have to understand is just like with Trump, what's really behind it? I mean, there's a lot of shiny baubles out there with Trump, and we all get pissed off about the stuff he says. But what's really going on with the tax cuts and so forth? So I thought this is interesting. So the fellow on the left, his name is Paulo Guedes, if I can pronounce that right. He's the economics minister. He's going to be the economics guy. He is the economics guy. And where was he? Where did he get his doctorate in
Chicago.
University of Chicago? So he has a neoliberal program, just and they want to implement it. The rumor is that they were able to stop this change in Social Security because of these massive protests and the general strike. But the word is that as soon as the election's over, they're gonna push it again. They don't give up. The election, the runoff is on this Sunday. I'm not optimistic. I think Bolsonaro is playing the Trump card really excellently. There's one piece of hope around this, and we'll find this interesting. He's been accused, the Folha de São Paulo, which is the São Paulo's largest newspaper, it's the closest thing to the New York Times there is in Brazil, and it's not a global newspaper, which is the important thing, did an expose on the use of social media by the Bolsonaro campaign. So again, they have strict laws. If you disseminate false information in any manner, that's an electoral crime, and you can be barred from the election. You can be actually thrown off the election. And so the scandal is that one of the big large industrial corporations in Brazil funded a program to flood social media. Sound familiar? With both pro-Bolsonaro, but also false information, and they actually call it in Brazil now fake news. They've adopted that. They call it fake news instead of noticias falsas, which would be the Portuguese way of saying it. It'd be fake news, but also with lies about Haddad and the Workers' Party and so forth. And it was put before the Electoral Commission yesterday. The Electoral Court, and the Electoral Court said, we need more evidence, but we're going to look into it. Now, theoretically, it probably won't happen before the election on Sunday. In fact, it won't happen before the election Sunday. But theoretically, if they find that the Bolsonaro campaign took this money under the table, they're going to, and used it to disseminate fake news, he can be removed from office because of that, because then it was false election. I talk to my lawyer friends in Brazil, and they tell me that it's all true. It's probably all, he probably is guilty of it, but the institutions in Brazil are not functioning right now. And so the chances of them actually happening are slim. So I think we can expect that Trump's going to have a big-time partner, a big league partner, as you say, in Brazil starting Sunday. Well, actually starting January 1st. So one of the big campaigns against Bolsonaro is called LA Now, which translates to Not Him, which is largely a woman-organized program given his misogyny. And they've been holding demonstrations. There's an LA Now demonstration. There, and here's another one. And I have a short video. I'm sorry. I don't have an answer, Libby. I don't know because the people, I mean, even if you get it, remember, it's a country of... The question is, why with all those people demonstrating, how can the election be close? Which I'm afraid is not close. I'm afraid Bolsonaro may win by, 10 or 12 points at this point. Even if you get 2 or 3 million people on the streets, it's a country of 210 million people, and the electoral is a lot larger than that. And it's the same thing with Trump. They want to drain the swamp. They want, people are tired of the elites. See, And Bolsonaro has less of a claim of being an elite than Trump does. He's not a billionaire. He was a military guy. They want something different. They're tired of the corruption. They're tired of the. But they're going to find out, just like people I hope in this country are finding out, unfortunately, that as they're trying to gut health care here, that's one of the things they want to defund the public health system there. They want to defund. Education, they want to defund, and privatize just like here. So I don't know, what's going to happen with those elections. But
look how big all the demonstrations were against the war in Iraq back in 2002.
Yeah.
When there were millions of people all over the world, that didn't stop.
There's also a campaign called Blank Slate, turning in a blank ballot. In other words, not voting for either. It'll hurt Haddad. So this was before the first round, obviously. And this is the website of the Friends of the MST, the website. We have lots of information on the election, more in-depth articles. More. Oh, yeah, that's what we do. We translate them from Portuguese to English. And there's some literature back there. The pamphlets, please feel free to take. The booklets, if you can leave a donation. They're about the MST, not another subject for another time, which I'd be happy to present, but just in case you're interested.
Do you think any of those candidates, the voters would go
Yeah, I think, yes, the leftists will go, and but there's still some far-right ones, too, that'll go for... And since he was so close in the first, it's really... It's difficult for me to imagine that he won't get elected on Sunday. So, I mean, that's the reality of it. Okay, the question is that Brazil is part of what's called the BRICS, which were these expanding economies in the late 90s and early part of this century. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Well, China buys soybeans from Brazil. Brazil's, I think, their largest supplier. And now, particularly with the tariffs, that helps. So when they say support, yeah, there's trade between them. I'm not sure. There's trade between them, I'm sure. I don't know exactly. Other than China and soybeans, I'm sure there's other things, too. I mean, Brazil manufactures a lot of stuff. Well, we're a competitor on soybean. Most of the stuff that they would produce we're competitive on. The United States is. I mean, one of their largest manufacturers that's unique is they have an airplane manufacturing, Embraer, which is competes with like Gulfstream, that type of smaller jets. So that's competition. I assume there's stuff that we import from Brazil. I mean, there's trade with Brazil. One of the things that's happening is that U.S. farmers are selling their land here at what, I don't know what land sells for anymore, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 an acre. And they're going down to Brazil and buying, you know, the same equivalent amount of land for a few thousand an acre and introducing the same sort of monoculture, large-scale agriculture that we have here, soybeans, corn. The question. One thing I can tell you, the Olympics and the World Cup, which were both held in Brazil, are a source of much discontent in Brazil. And that was when the Michel Temer, the guy who succeeded Dilma, went to the Olympics, he was booed. And you know, they did the Olympics, especially since that was all in Rio de Janeiro, they cleared out, just like what happened here, which is why we opposed it here. They cleared out large numbers of poor people so they could build rebuild the stadium, and all the facilities that the Olympics require. And those poor people were just dislocated with, you know, virtually no help whatsoever. So I was in Brazil when they were granted the Olympics the people around me, even, you know, the progressives, they're excited, you know, because finally people will see, you know, Brazil as a country other than its caricature. I said, okay, you're going to regret it, but one has to see for themselves. So the question is to discuss the shortcomings of the Workers' Party, the PT, and how that sort of laid the groundwork for what's happening today. The Workers' Party, when it was formed, was a party of socialism. They advocated for socialism. And over the years, in order to get elected, I mean, because Lula ran either three or four times before he got elected. And then in order to get elected, they moderated, you know, and they came much more like a social democratic party. And the trade they made, the bargain they made was with the devil, was with international capital. And that was because they weren't going to disrupt the commodity export market, because that was what they were going to use to feed their programs. And the national bourgeoisie of the country, which is, you know, the landowners and so forth, went along with that program and went along with the program of these social programs for a number of reasons. One of them was, of course, international capital said it was okay, right? So they bow to that. A second one was that it wasn't going to impinge too greatly on their own operations. Yes, they were going to pay more taxes, but that was not... They at that point, they weren't as phobic about the taxes because the economy was really going well. So everybody was making money. And the other reason is that when the money went into the pockets of the poor and working class, they bought stuff. And that increased the economy, right? And so they were buying from stuff produced domestically, by and large. And so that made those companies more profitable. So there was a quid pro quo in that respect. And the quote I read from Stedile, who was the leader, one of the leaders of the MST, points it out. He said, Dilma's second term was a disaster. She immediately caved to big business on everything. You know, she if I could turn a noun into a verb, she Hillary Clintonized herself. And which doesn't mean she deserved to be impeached, because, you know, and it was really the reason that the Workers' Party, as I tried to explain, hopefully I did, the reason the Workers' Party got pushed out of power was because of the crisis, because of the economic crisis, the recession. The fall in profits, and they had to find a way to squeeze it, and the Workers' Party was not going to squeeze its base the way they wanted it to be squeezed. I'm talking about the working class. They weren't going to squeeze them. They weren't going to require additional hours for no pay, which is one of the things they're trying to push now. They weren't going to destroy the Social Security provisions and raise the age to start collecting Social Security. They weren't going to tear down the public health system. So those are things that they weren't going to do, and that international capital and local decided had to be done in order to restore profits. So that's the reason they got pushed out. I mean, the corruption is just an excuse. You know, the budget irregularities, as Dilma did, you know, that's an excuse. In fact, immediately after Temer took power, he introduced a legislation which legitimized exactly what she did so he could do it. So, you know, let's not kid ourselves what's going on there. So, who is it? Sure. In the agricultural sector, it's Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, Syngenta, Monsanto, now Bayer. Bayer bought out Monsanto, for those who haven't followed that. So that's in the agricultural sector. In the automotive sector, it's General Motors, it's Fiat, it's Mercedes-Benz. And it's also, then, of course, the money capital, Goldman Sachs. The banks of Europe, whose names I don't know off the top of my head, the banks in England, all that you know, finance projects. I mean, and it's the oil industry, because of that offshore oil it's a massive reserve they discovered, but it's in fairly deep water, about 120 miles offshore, and so and Petrobras doesn't have the experience for those deep water wells. So they're bringing, you know, so that now we're talking about BP Amoco. We're talking about Mobil Exxon. They've always had a presence in Brazil. The energy industry, about, I think it's 70% of Brazil's energy comes from hydroelectric. And one of the big companies there is Duke Energy. See, there was a big, during the boom years, there was a huge expansion of credit in Brazil, both at the corporate and national level, but also at the individual level. So people had access to credit, which again, you know, allowed them to buy cars, washing machines, dryers, you know, all the different household appliances, which again fed the economy. That credit has fallen off the wayside and people are in debt. And again, that ran its course. Unlike here, where we seem to keep generating more debt no matter what, so. But I haven't read anything specifically about a specific sabotage program. Look, back in the 64 coup, Dulles, called, was it Dulles? Yeah, under Kennedy, under Johnson, I mean. Rusk, I'm sorry, it was Rusk. Under Johnson, called up the generals and said, do you need our help? And they said, no, we got it. We said, well, the Fifth Fleet is offshore just in case. And there's recordings of that, so. I'm just not making it up. So, you know, there's some concept that the NSA has been involved in some of this media stuff that I was talking about, so-called fake news, that they've been involved in helping to plant stuff. But again, I haven't read anything definitive, just hints at it.
The Workers' Party now, is that basically an electoral party, or is it something more than that?
Yeah, it's an electoral party, yeah. It's not a. They're not doing the organization that you would think of for a left-wing party in terms of organizing a base and programs for the base and so forth. It's an electoral party. In some ways, they rely on the Movimiento Sin Tierra, the landless workers movement, to do a lot of that for them, because they're the ones who are organizing on the ground. And they are supporting this campaign because they do better in democracy than they do under a dictatorship. So that's why they're supporting the PT. And there's always been cross relations between the MST and the Workers' Party. But the MST is an unarmed movement, except for the fact that they will defend themselves with their machetes and hoes and things like that if they're under attack. But their view is the minute they pick up arms, the military is going to come in. And even though they're approximately 0.75% of the population, you know, in other words, the movement has about 1.7 million people. So that's, you know, out of 200 and some million, that's like 0.75%, which when you think about it, is a massive, a large movement. That's an activist movement. They're the most militant. Well, but you know, I shouldn't say that. The labor unions are very militant in Brazil. They're very militant and they're very active, both the public and the private sector unions. There's a large, I'll call it homeless movement, but you know, urban homeless movement called the Sem Teto, which translates to is without roof. That's very militant. They do a lot of taking over of buildings in cities, just like the MST takes over land in the rural areas. So there's a lot of movements, but to my knowledge, none of them are armed or even talking about that. I mean, it's not that stage. I mean,
and the transportation workers,
they had a massive strike. Part of it was because this is in São Paulo. In specific, they raised the fare on the subways and buses, and cut the workers' wages at the same time. So it's sort of like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So they're fairly militant. I don't know much about them other than that they had a strike. They were occupying the different subway stations at different points. He wants to know when Dilma essentially told Netanyahu to take a jump off a cliff, figuratively, because of what he had done in Gaza. Whether that had anything to do with her being impeached, and I don't think there's any, no, I doubt it. I mean, that's Brazil, like a lot of the world, understands that Israel is a colonial power and has displaced Palestinians. There's not really much debate about it when you go into the, you know, anywhere but the U.S., I suppose parts of Europe, but I don't think that was an issue. I don't think people cared about that. This Eduardo Cunha, who, because of the scandals, was forced to resign as president of their House of Representatives, is an evangelical. But so I assume he's an Israel supporter, as most evangelicals seem to be. There's a big split, incidentally. You know, evangelicals are a growing part of the population of Brazil. Brazil used to be somewhere in the mid-80s Catholic, Roman Catholic. Now it's somewhere down in the upper 60s percentage of the population, yeah. And the growth has been in evangelical Christians, is the growth. But they're fairly split on Bolsonaro. Unlike, interestingly enough, I just read an article today, in fact, that said that there's a split among them because of his misogyny and his disrespect of people of color. So there's some split there. I mean, I don't know how significant it is and well how it'll affect them.
Why have so many non-rich people voted for him?
Yeah. Why'd they vote for Trump? Why working class people
vote?
But
they didn't hear.
A lot of people didn't vote because it was Hillary as the alternative.
And Bolsonaro was playing the exact same card. You know, the Workers' Party had been in power for, 14 years before Dilma was impeached. There's, you know, they're the establishment. you know, and the establishment has now brought us to ruin because of the recession. I mean, 12.5% unemployment, and I'm sure that's undercounting, just like our unemployment rates undercount. There's a lot of marginal work and so forth. So, you know, how do you explain the phenomena of people voting against their own self-interest? He's very much playing on the tough on crime. I'll bring order to the country. The cities of Brazil have issues. I mean, there is a lot of crime in those cities, and you know, and there's a lot of violence, and it's not a good situation. His solution, of course, is essentially military occupation of the cities. I read a statistic. Let's see if I can remember the number. What percentage of the deaths by guns are people caught in the crossfire between the police and gangs? I mean, in some of those places, it's fairly open warfare. You know, it's not a good situation, but the solution is not to go in there and shoot them all. So the MST was formed at the end of the military dictatorship in 1984. It arose out of spontaneous occupations of land in the south of the country. In the south of the country, in Rio Grande do Sul, and in these parts of the country, there was a bunch of spontaneous land occupations beginning in 1982, 83, and then in 84, they started organizing themselves as, the full name of it is the Movement of Rural Workers Without Land, Movimento dos Trabalhadores Rurais Sem Terra. And they were then joined by some seminarians. Brazil has about 200, I'm trying to remember the name of it, they're Catholic, leftist Catholic communities. And there's still about 200 of them left in Brazil. So Brazil has a long history of liberation theology, support for liberation theology in the Catholic Church. And a lot of that was suppressed during the military dictatorship, of course. And so there were some seminarians in that joined with them and helped them, their peasants, organize. And it's grown from there. So their strategy is pretty basic. Brazil's constitution says that if land doesn't serve a social purpose, it can be expropriated and provided to those that will use it for social purpose. And its social purpose is defined as the land is productive. These are all ors, so any one of these. The land is productive, or you know, if the land is not productive, it can be expropriated. If the land violates the labor laws, like slave labor, I can give you another point on that in a second, slave labor, if it violates the environmental laws, and there's a third one that's a little more nebulous, or fourth one, I mean, is a little more nebulous. So if any land, any piece of land, violates any of those four criteria, and of course that's in the Constitution, that there's a bunch of laws that sort of keep defining them and what's productive and set forth and so on, but those were never enforced. So those are in the Constitution. Brazil's Constitution is from 1988. It's a really progressive constitution because it came after the end of the dictatorship when the social movements and the labor unions and so forth were in ascendancy. They had just overthrown a dictatorship. I'm going to give one caveat on they'd overthrown the dictatorship. Part of the reason the generals gave up power, and I don't know how much part of that reason, is the strikes in the automotive factories. The international automobile manufacturers, General Motors, Ford, Fiat, said, whoa, if you can't control the people through the dictatorship, then you better learn to control them through democracy. So essentially there were some ultimatums given to the military dictators. That wasn't the whole reason, but that was part of it, you know. And they say, look at our model. We have democracy and we keep our people under control. So the Constitution's very progressive. But of course nobody was going to enforce that provision of the Constitution. So the MST's model is they find a piece of these large landed states. They're called latifundia, and they're huge. Some of them the size of Rhode Island. That's one family's property.
Wow.
But there's portions of them that they go and occupy them. It's of course a very difficult process because you occupy the land and you can't farm it. There's a government agency whose acronym is INCRM. It's the National Institute for Colonization and Agrarian Reform. So they're the whose goal is to implement agrarian reform. So once they occupy the land, then they'll petition this agency to say, you know, to certify that it meets the qualifications for expropriation. There's battles over it. Of course, many of the landowners don't even want to deal with the court processes. That they just send in goons to, you know, to drive them out, either shoot them out. There's been about 1,700 peasants involved in agrarian reform killed since 1984. You know, and the owner of the land does get compensation. They get government bonds to pay for the land. And then it's similar to eminent domain here, except for a different purpose. But that's what they do, and they force it, and they've done, they've settled about 375,000 families on lands in these agrarian reform settlements, about 1.7 million people. There's 90,000 families, actually, no, it's up to 120,000 families in occupations. We didn't get their land rights. What we do here is we're a support organization for the MST. So we provide, so our mission is to bring them, translate and bring the materials to the MST so people, to give forums like this around the MST. We bring MST people from Brazil up here so they can, generate support. And likewise, we organize delegations down to Brazil. We fundraise mostly for their school. They have a school about 60 kilometers outside of São Paulo, Escola Nacional Florestan Fernandes. They're in 23 of the 27 states. The states they're not in have large indigenous populations, like the Amazon. They have large indigenous populations, and they don't. And their position is that that's indigenous land, and they're not going to occupy land that should belong to the indigenous, even if it's been pushed out. So they've been pushed off of it or put on reservations, just like our native population here. So they're in 20, I think it's 23 out of the 27 states, and they've done thousands of occupations and thousands of settlements. They have a vast network of cooperatives, both for production cooperatives and retail cooperatives. They have agro industries on their so the settlements consist of anywhere from 40 or 50 families up to several thousand families. And so those are the settlements. They're agrarian reform settlements. And they farm.
Monoculture?
No, they use agroecology for the most part. They've returned a lot of the land to organic farming, both because it's cheaper and you don't need all those chemical inputs, which are really expensive and are only good for large-scale production anyway. They also have like bakeries. They make the Brazilian liquor, cachaça, which is made from sugar cane, which they grow. They cooperatives, and they vary in terms of how they're organized. So the goal of the MST is not just agrarian reform. It's to create a culture of what they call citizenship. In other words, people taking control of their own lives. And it starts with an occupation. So if you think about it, in the middle of the night, 90, 100, 200 people, maybe 500 or 1,000, I've seen and read about them as big as 5,000 people, go and take over a piece of land. They set up these black plastic tents using tree limbs and whatever the materials they can have. They bring in stoves, they bring it in, they set up, and they're there. Right, unused private property, right. That's because it meets one of the criteria. Usually,
there could be a manor house there somewhere.
Oh, there is often. What? Yeah, yeah. The
miles away.
Or it could be, but it could be just 10 kilometers away too, or 2 kilometers away. So it's not. All depends, there's a lot of gamesmanship, of course, by the owners, but so they occupy this land, and then they have to self-organize. Because they have to survive. I mean, you think about it. Let's just say you have 500 families, which is not an atypical number for an occupation. 500 families could be 2,500 people easily. right, or 2,000 people. And they have to self-organize, you know, and they have to figure out how they're going to survive. I mean, nobody's going to get, there's no government program to give them money, to give them, to feed them.
They won't get a crop until next year.
Well, and a lot of times they can't even farm the land until it's been certified, until they've gotten the certification through the government, through that whole process. So yeah, so they work in the, they hike into the cities and work, and that's how they get, you know, they tap into the electric lines, you know, and bring electricity. But they set up schools. You know, all the kids get educated.
They have subsistence gardens.
They do. Right around.
That's not considered farming.
Right. They're not really going into the fields, and they self-organize that way, and that of course builds cohesion and so forth and so on. And now the settlements themselves, once they have land rights, they're really not threatened. But nobody owns the land. The land is, the best way I can describe it using our legal terminology is the land's put into a trust, and they can't buy or sell it. Nobody can. If they build a home on it, they have the right to recoup their cost of materials and labor. If they decide they're going to leave for whatever reason and somebody else says, I'd like that, they can recoup their, you know, cost and labor. There are some that are very collectivized. In other words, they everything is done on a collective basis. All the farming is done on a collective basis. The industry is done on a collective basis. The noon meal, which is the biggest meal of the day, and this is always true in rural areas, is always done on a collective basis. There's kitchens. They have big kitchens. They all come in. There's people whose job it is to prepare the food. They have rotating duties, shift duties, and so forth and so on. And some of them are much more individualistic. You know, and it's typical of a new settlement when they gain land is I want my piece of land. I want my chunk of land. And then sometimes they realize that they need to cooperate among themselves to survive. And so, I mean, so it's a dynamic movement. They have newspapers, radio stations, television stations. They have... like I said, a whole system of schools. They have the school and the university they built outside of São Paulo, Escola Nacional. Not only has classes in agroecology and those sort of things, they also have the word in Portuguese is called formação, and in Spanish, for those who speak Spanish, is formación, which essentially is. It translates literally into training. It's political education, is what it is, and essentially what they're saying is it's formação for the formadores. So it's training for the trainers. So they train people in political education. They're 6-week courses. They're about 6-7 weeks all down there. They've obviously started in Portuguese. They've had them in Spanish for a number of years. For the last 4 or 5 years, they have them in English. And they teach basic, you know, Marxist political education and political economy and so forth. So that's interesting. In fact, organizations here, they have to be grassroots organizations, movement organizations. They can apply to send somebody to the school for these programs. It's cost free. In other words, airfare, everything is funded. Yeah, for the English speaking ones. The students are from, U.S., Canada, South Africa, Palestine, India. I don't know about Pakistan, but India sends people. So there's Nepal, places where there's a fair amount of English speakers. So, and the MST has been involved in those. The MST has sent people, they were asked to send people to help them organize the occupations. So there's... mostly publicity and you know, they're not blocked. I mean, they have their own private armies. Yeah. They have state and federal. At least under the PT governments, the federal military police stayed out of it. They were instructed to. But the state military police can be in it if it's a non-progressive state governor or government. And they have private armies. And the agro industrial companies, the Syngenta, had hired an army to drive occupiers off land it was illegally using. It was doing GMO work, planting with too close to a federal land preserve. So Brazil was one of the last countries in the world to abolish slavery. 1888 was when it was finally abolished. But there was a lot of runaway slaves, and they set up their own communities, some of them incredibly large, and they fought pitched battles, sometimes with the military. Sometimes they fought them to a standstill, other times they lost. Those communities are called quilomba, and those communities today have a fair amount of influence and power. Power's not the right word. They have influence because they're large and people need to go to them. But they're also under a lot of attack. And one of the things that, Bolsonaro, of course, because they're black, has no regard for them, and who knows what will happen.
Do any people of color, are they in the parliament?
Yeah. I find race is a really different issue in Brazil than it is here. I mean, there's racism, and by and large, the elite is all would all be European descended people. Besides Portuguese and Spanish, there's large German communities. There's a large Italian community.
Yeah, there was a huge influx of German Nazis after the Second World War.
And they're in the south of the country, and that's where they still go looking for these 6 foot blonde, blue eyed Brazilian women to be models, like what's her name, Gisele, Tom Brady's wife, for those who know who she is. But the elite is largely European descended, I mean, by and large. The difference I found, and I found this sort of universally throughout as I tried to interact with people, is that among the working class and poor, there's virtually no racism. Unlike our white working class can be incredibly racist, as we all know. But there's virtually none among, I shouldn't say none, there's always exceptions, but it's really not a dominant aspect of life, because if you're poor, you're poor, and if you're working class, you're working class, and if you're dark or white. Besides, majority of the country is non-white. I mean, that's the other thing, 53% of the country is non-white, so it's, that's huge. I mean, in terms of that, Bolsonaro was always an incredibly marginal figure throughout his entire political life. I mean, really marginal. He's been a member of like a dozen different parties because he keeps getting booted out of each party because he's so extremely reactionary. And he just caught the tailwind of this international populism, or fascism, or whatever you want to call it, neo-fascism. And I think he just caught the tailwind of it, and that combined with the corruption, and in particular the recession. Nobody wanted to back Trump. Nobody wanted to back Bolsonaro. The Brazilian corporations, the Brazilian elite, hands off. They had other candidates that they wanted, but now that he's there, they're all falling in line, just like they are with Trump. So I think I don't think it was promoted because of that. The U.S. farmers are pissed about this, of course, about these tariffs, because that's opened the market even more for Brazil. Particularly, I mean, with China, because they consume a lot of soybeans, and that's one of their biggest export crops. If not, that probably is their biggest export crop.
Are their soybeans as full of Roundup and whatever all that stuff is as ours?
It never used to be. It's only in the last few years that's really taken hold. GMO crops, they had no GMO crops, but now they're coming, and that's because of the foothold that the PT, the Workers' Party, let for U.S. and European agro companies. ADM, Cargill, Syngenta.
We have to be out here at 9 o'clock and take some time to... Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.